I'm Christopher Lydon, retaking the empire question with the transatlantic, volcanic, epic, and elegant fount of history and historical ideas, Simon Sharma, in his office at Columbia University. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Simon Sharma, there's always an embarrassment of riches of things that we could be hearing about from you, books, news, television shows. But I would love to bear down on this question burning in my little brain these last 10 years or so, how we Americans let ourselves into the failed or exhausted, abandoned Britain campaigns to run Iraq and Afghanistan, Iran too once upon a time, and Egypt in its day. How did we stick ourselves with an imperial mandate and more an imperial attitude in the world? And is there a way out of it?
It's easiest, Chris, to answer the last question, and I will have a crack at answering all of them. The answer to the last question is no. The only way you actually get yourself out of an imperial role is to collapse. So actually, it's very hard to think of, really, a presidential ticket, you know, the collapsing American power ticket, really. Unlikely to have much success, I'd say. Now, very often, the beginning of imperial responsibility is nailed to the presidency, not without reason, of Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century, and arguably, one might say, actually, William McKinley and the annexation of Hawaii not long before that. However, it won't surprise you to hear, you know, with my sort of old historian's hat on, I think the story is a bit older than that and really goes back to one of the original sins of the foundation of the Republic. So these original sins almost always collapse back on the incredibly complicated, endlessly fascinating figure of Thomas Jefferson. One sin being, how is it you can be a democratic egalitarian and a slave owner at the same time? The other one, to which much, much less attention is paid, is the following. How do you seriously deal simultaneously with the notion that you are going someday to be a mighty continental republic, and really kid yourself into believing that the two oceans, Atlantic and Pacific, will protect you from the world power system? You could say, well, we're going to keep our virginity forever. Providence has given us the enormous gift of these oceans. So everything will be fine with our democratic continental expansionist future. Because the only people who are going to be affected by it might be the indigenous peoples of the country, and they too will be very quickly grateful for the gifts and fruits of civilization. So they're not going to be a problem. The Indians aren't going to be a problem either. Here's why you were really kidding yourself in the Jeffersonian period that early. There are two words, Napoleon Bonaparte. It wasn't that Napoleon Bonaparte was off somewhere doing what he had to do in France and in continental Europe. The French armies were there in massive presence in the Caribbean, in what's now the Dominican Republic, in Saint-Domingue, because that was a place of immense... It was a slave island. It was the great engine of riches in the sugar trade. There was a huge French army, not doing very well. And, you know, we always think of it, the Napoleon-Jefferson psychological conflict being really not problematic because of the Louisiana Purchase. But the truth of it is really, Jefferson as an old honeymooner in revolutionary France, having seen the halcyon days of the revolution and then seen it deteriorate into a quasi-military dictatorship, and having that dictatorship with its soldiers breathed down the neck of the young republic, was faced with a decision, as was John Adams, really. Can we actually afford, really, to have no army, no navy, go our way in the world? Or do we actually have to look out for ourselves by a projection of power? And, of course, the projection of power in Jefferson's case was not, although, you know, came close to it, come to an all-out conflict with the enormous power of Imperial France. It was to take it to the Barbary Corsairs, to the states of the Maghreb, our first naval war, our first war with the foreign enemy, our first complicated treaty, and so on. So already it was in the mind of the Founding Fathers, even two Founding Fathers who disagreed so fundamentally as Adams and Jefferson, that it was just utopian to pretend that we could be America and just, you know, batten down the hatches and pretend, and make the world, rest of the world, go away. So we've got a century of preparation, really, for the Teddy Roosevelt moment, by which we say to ourselves, we're not really an empire, we're just defending freedom. But to do it, by God, we better do it with the big stick when we need to.
The myth, the animating notion, isolationist and maybe delusional though it is, was in Ronald Reagan, as recently as Ronald Reagan, one of the big ideas in American life. Where did that go?
The greatest statesman, I mean, not to diss the complicated, sometimes enigmatic psychology of Ronald Reagan, sometimes childish and sometimes really quite sophisticated, but the really great statesman from Washington onwards all had, was saturated in European history. Washington, of course, best friend Lafayette. Lafayette sends his son to live with Washington. Washington served in the British Army, understood the power struggle between France and Britain I promise you I'll get out of the 18th century in a minute, but the Tea Party doesn't want us to, and they sort of have a point. I mean, our DNA is formed truly in this period. John Adams thought the greatest, you know, the state which had somehow magically been able to combine effective power with riches and freedom was the Netherlands, was the United Provinces, where he became ambassador. Mm. Jefferson, we've already spoken about. So they all really were, you know, we think of Hamilton as the wiliest, cynical, most sophisticated figure, you know, who broods constantly and who wants there to be a tough army. But really, none of the Founding Fathers took the kind of proto-Reaganite view that you can, you know, you would just forever really be Dorothy in the Red Shoes, you know, that there'd always be no place like home. Jefferson had another very important thing, which lasts in deep into the 20th century, lasts now. Even if you could really manage, through the providential grace of the oceans, accomplish this isolation, and even if there was no Napoleon, because America was a new thing, you needed a friendly world for it to survive in. Hmm. You needed, ultimately, your trading with other countries. You know, you're never going to sort of cut yourself off completely. And when America becomes a gigantic, you know, immigrant empire, then, of course, some of the complications of what is our relationship to Germany, what is our relationship to Italy, what is our relationship with the Brits, and so on, is really kind of reinforced. So the temptation, strong in Woodrow Wilson's approach to both entering the First World War and trying to rebuild not just Europe but the world afterwards, is you need a world which honors the principles of self-determination and democracy if America is to survive and flourish. Competing with that sort of pragmatic idealism, which I think is not an oxymoron in this way, you need to be idealist to reshape the world so that America will flourish. It's kind of a neocon idea now, but it begins, you know, with Wilson and maybe earlier. Then there is simply the issue of, first of all, our interest in resources. We were, you know, and have been a so-called extractionist empire. When the Brits collapse, someone has to take over the issue of where strategic oil reserves are to be found. And then there is sort of overwhelmingly what focuses the attention of 20th century presidents, particularly Wilson and FDR and then Harry Truman, is that in the absence of a commanding great power, will essentially the instability of the world ultimately create a vortex into which America would be sucked? The lesson of the failure to ratify the Versailles Treaty was very profound for not just for Franklin Roosevelt, but figures like Dean Acheson and Harriman and ultimately Harry Truman. Harry Truman fought in the First World War, you know, we often forget. Right. So he knew, really, he was deeply aware of the catastrophe, not just for the rest of the world, but for America, of America turning its back on the League of Nations. How, in some sense, it predetermined the immense disaster which was going to be responsible for the loss of American life in the Second World War. So in some ways, this dream of the kind of continental empire of the free, an empire of liberty, always presupposed massive engagement. You were never going to get out of the way of that.
That's in our DNA, as you say. But start from today looking back. To my mind, the question is, how does the historian explain this projection of American power? It begins to look like a sort of repetition compulsion syndrome after Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan, with maybe Libya thrown in, or we'll see, and confusion about our place in Egypt. But how do we come to taking up these British burdens as if, you know, they were great opportunities, and do it again and again and again?
Well, because they're not seen to be British burdens, you know. They seem to be magically transformed by being wrapped in the Stars and Stripes, you know, even though you're right in saying to some extent they are. In fact, I mean, the weird thing is, of course, actually, the British in Afghanistan were there for entirely sort of dry-eyed, pragmatic, strategic reasons.
Talk about it.
Well, it was all to do with the neurosis about India and keeping India safe, and particularly the neurosis about the Russians, something that's never, ever gone away, still hasn't gone away. So the great game, so-called, about protecting, the nightmare was of a kind of combo of Afghan tribesmen provoked by wily Tsarist secret agents,
the stuff of Kim,
pouring over
all
the Hindu Kush and down into the fertile Ganges Valley, from which truly by the end of the 19th century, you know, a lot of investment had been sort of tied up. So that was the neurosis. It was then compounded by the fact that the root, this sort of nightmare pincer movement of Russian deviousness and untamable Waziristan Pashtun tribesmen, it was compounded by the fact that you're going right through what suddenly turned out to be an incredibly mineral and oil-rich region that you sure didn't want to abandon. In other words, northern Iran, central Iran, and, you know, even to this day, if we can only get the bloody stuff out of the ground, you know, Afghanistan's incredibly rich in copper and other very important sort of minerals. So, you know, what we tell ourselves, I think the key instance, really, Afghanistan is a very particular case. They're not all the same, Chris. Afghanistan, it was a response to a massacre in the city we're sitting in. What do you do? Nothing at all. And so, in some sense, actually, you know, once you move on from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda issue, the answer is all about West Pakistan, which has suddenly not gone away from the news. The problem with, hence the unlovely phrase AFPAC, the problem really, you know, we have modest ambitions about, which may well still not be fulfilled in Afghanistan. The scary bit is really all about Pakistan, because Pakistan is nuclear armed. The possibility of an Indo-Pakistan nuclear exchange grows closer, in my view, not further away. When we depart from Afghanistan, there's a possibility of a kind of de facto partition, almost, of East Afghanistan between a kind of reinstatement of the Northern Alliance backed by the Russians in the north and a very Taliban-friendly, if not an actual Taliban, Afghanistan in the south. Once there's, you know, that's actually going to be a huge Indian-Pakistan problem. I mean, the issue about us in Afghanistan is really seeing the failure of Pakistan as a state as a potentially catastrophic situation because of its nuclear arms.
Do you really believe, though, that our war in Afghanistan is helping deal with this incredibly threatening Pakistan situation?
Well, it's more like it's trying to hold the line at, you know, preventing the Taliban simply reconquering the entire country. But most of all, it is an issue of what happens if we leave precipitously, or when we leave eventually. How can you actually control this whole very, very volatile, dangerous region from being, you know, a threat to South Asia generally? And the issue will eventually become one of what, you know, the only possible answer, if there is an answer, which there may not be, is some sort of international framework in which a kind of cordon sanitaire is placed around Afghanistan so that it is sufficiently free from becoming a dependency of a nuclear-armed jihadi fundamentalism as to make it a little bit safer. I don't know if that can be done. It depends on, you know, I mean, a lot depend on actors who we think of as remote, the Russians, above all the Chinese, who still have a close relationship with the Pakistanis. So these are complications. But what is quite clear, if you're in the mindset of the American, any American administration, you know, including Dennis, President Kucinich or President Ron Paul, you know, they would still have to face the issue. If you actually bolt from the region and prepare to let everything fall down as it stands, dealing with the scary consequences of that, I think.
What does a historian observe about our own mindset as a country, if you can generalize? How in the last 10 years, I don't think we've shaken the Bush influence yet, did we come to feel imperial?
Well, I mean, you know, Second World War, the dropping of the atomic bomb on Japan. I mean, that has a lot to do with the whole experience of the war, in which we, you know, arguably we were the difference in 1917, 1918, and then we were absolutely the difference again in the Second World War. So you could not help that. And I think the part of the question, I think what you have in mind, but you'll correct me, Chris, if I'm wrong, is that since 9/11 in particular, the sense of kind of chest-beating exceptionalism, if anyone demurs at the idea of American exceptionalism, you'll hear the radio talk show host rant about Obama going around the world apologizing for American exceptionalism. He's never, ever done that, quite the opposite sometimes. So this sort of neurotic insistence on USA, USA, number one, exceptional, special in the world, and so on. Sort of the neurosis of feeling weak, of course, actually. Of actually feeling angry, as though someone else was responsible for our economic plight, for the collapse at the end of 2008, for the fact that we have an overstretched military, for the fact that we don't have the global throw power that we had, indeed, actually, when we were fighting massive war on two fronts in the 1940s. So that the kind of more... The more haunted we are by the difficulty of sustaining an imperial reality, the more noisy and truculent and bellicose we are actually about, you know, our sort of collective fist in the air.
And how is that condition? I mean, you're talking about a psychiatric problem, but how is that to be treated, Simon?
That's a real toughie, actually. That is very hard.
That is
what
my question,
Obama,
I think.
It's incredibly hard to do. I mean, obviously, the killing of Osama bin Laden calms it down a bit. I mean, you know, it's success really calms. Failure, frustration, aggravation really, you know, powers up the testosterone of fury, really. But in the long term, you know, Obama's whole project, which is incredibly difficult to bring off, is basically to be the manager of declining expectations. That's the secret, really, both economically and in terms of the amount of global power we can afford. The amount of global power we can afford, making difficult decisions. You know, we have a kind of a deficit problem in funding our foreign and military policy too. Now, you can't, again, go to the hustings and go to the people saying, my plan for the future of the great American Republic is that we become more ordinary, that we run foreign policy on the cheap, and that we have a sort of humbler posture in the world. No. That's not going to go down a treat. You have to lie about it. You have to really, you know, it's particularly the case, I suppose, with the perceived threat of the Chinese replacing us in some peculiar way. You know, that's not going to happen for a very, very long time, if it happens at all. But the notion is somehow there is this... you know, unentitled, enigmatic, what is it, a communist society or a capitalist society? Damned if we know. There's a sort of sense that they've taken all our manufacturing jobs from us. They hold us hostage through the possession of massive treasury bond reserves and so on. So, you know, you really do have to educate the American Republic in a more realistic view of what's possible in the American future. And as you'd say, good luck on that one, mate, as we say in Britain.
Simon Chapman, one more question out of the British record. I found myself looking for anti-imperial voices in England through the whole 19th century, before and after, actually.
Yeah.
To my mind, the question is, where is our version of the great Edmund Burke, who was fierce against the rather Rumsfeldian, Cheney-esque Bush abuses of the East India Company in India, and he put Warren Hastings of the East India Company on trial for impeachment, the noblest moment of his life. I keep wondering, where is that voice in our own culture of restraint and a certain humility? And also, in this moment where a kind of empire may be unavoidable, he was a spokesman for imperial justice, for treating others as we would want to be treated, as in every dimension, human equals.
Yeah. Well, the two crucial things about Burke, apart from his eloquence, was he was Irish and therefore had a very strong sense, actually, of being on the receiving end of injustice. And also that he had, as you know, in his kind of mystical romanticism, a truly romantic with a capital R, you know, as in romantic movement, a kind of strong sense of the special gift that had been bequeathed from the mists of the Middle Ages of parliamentary liberty to modern Britain. And so he would have been, as it were, a British, an Anglo-Irish, really, exceptionalist. And he felt as, you know, I suppose some libertarians in America feel this way. I'm sure, you know, having been rude about Ron Paul earlier, I'm sure he does feel that, actually, that that special gift is always contaminated by the exercise of indecent, self-interested, muscular power. Right. But the answer why there is no Burke now is because actually our God is business, and business is not just preoccupied with the creation of software and the manufacture of widgets, if widgets are still being manufactured anywhere in the United States rather than in Pudong or Mumbai. Our business is also with making money from raw power. Hello Halliburton, hello Brown, I can't remember the name. You know, hello privatization of security agencies all over the world. And therefore, in some sense, the God of business also silences, muffles the voice, even of those on the right, really, who you might expect to actually see that there is kind of indecent corruption, governments being built, incompetence on the ground, the failure for a long time of supplying basic electricity and water and so on to the nation we promised we were rebuilt in the spirit of democracy in Iraq and so on. So in some sense, really, where you would most expect the indignation to be most vocal is really compromised by the fact that America, you know, what's left of American democracy is essentially a moneyed oligarchy. I sound myself sounding like Howard Zinn, which surprises me slightly, but he wasn't always wrong.
So the voice of experience from an Anglo-American perspective is be prepared or practice going gracefully if a way can be found. Is there any way, Simon Chama, to make it sound like a good deal for America, as it has been a good deal for the old European empires to come
to
home?
To withdraw. Is there a way? Yes, I think so. I think so. That my other country is a small island, you know, 60 million population or so. And therefore, it took a long time. I mean, I grew up in a period of declinism, really, where we got used to runs on the pound, of botched fiascos like the Suez in 1956, a long, bloody, somber education in our limitations. But there was something always about the British temper that was historically ironic. At least when I grew up, notwithstanding the gorgeousness of Churchillian rhetoric, there was also the sense that history is a kind of tableau of tragic irony, and even Thucydides saw that in the overreach. You know, one thing about being a faculty person, a historian in Britain, and coming to America, for which I've always been grateful, I mean, I've always been incredibly lucky to teach in American universities, not least because I do, as you know, Chris, very wacky combo of art history and anthropology and so
on.
And that, for some bizarre reason, undeserved good fortune. The institutions I've taught in have been hospitable to that in a way they certain, I think they really weren't in Britain. But one thing you learn, of course, actually, is that if you, it's in vain to hope for an irony implant. Twain was very exceptional. H.L. Mencken was never a cross-section of the American public, in my view, any more than, say, Woody Allen. Irony is in very short supply on Capitol Hill, and it's regarded as a kind of jaded European admission of defeat, really. That, again, we'll get back now to our founding fathers. The only figure among the great founding fathers, really, who had no problem with irony at the same time as he had no problem about envisioning a great continental democratic future was, of course, the peerless Benjamin Franklin.
Yes.
Who could put all those things together in an undefensive way. And we've sort of, you know, lacked that ever since. So that is very, very tricky. I suspect, you know, I'll be long since gone to the buttercups and the tombs of my fathers. But in the end, as with the late... The question is really more about Imperial Rome, I suspect. We will simply, over a long period of time, become accustomed to our limitations. And at some point in the future, there will be some, you know, Edward Gibbon sitting in the ruins, not of the Forum, but maybe...
In this very office, I expect. Go ahead.
Meditating, really, on the decline and fall of the American Empire and getting it, nailing it much more exactly than I've been able to for you.
That'll do, Mr. Gibbon. Simon Chama, it's always such a pleasure, such a mesmerizing experience to just to hear you talk, first of all, but then to go home and listen carefully to what you said. Thank you.
Dear Christopher, you need to get out more, but thank you very much.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.